Coming up, Beverly D'Angelo joins Ileana in just a minute.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies.
And now, it's the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast, starring Ileana Douglas. Eavesdrop with Ileana as she interviews Hollywood's most prominent players about filmmaking, acting, and what really happens on the set of your favorite flicks and TV shows.
Hello, everyone. I am Ileana Douglas. Welcome to the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast. I'm here with my lovely co-host, Tamara Bird.
Hi, everybody.
And very excited to have Beverly D'Angelo on.
Yeah.
Again, I've been stalking her, known Bev for many years. We were in, this is like, should be a special like showbiz category. If you're in the film, but you have no scenes together. We were both in the film Lansky. But we never both married to Richard Dreyfuss at various times in the film. I think I was Mrs. Lansky number one, and she was Mrs. Lansky number two.
Oh,
and but we never we didn't cross paths, but we met each other socially over the years.
That must be really interesting to be in a movie with someone and never actually meet until like a lot of
at
times you'll meet at the premiere, right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Hi, good friends.
I know, but of course I've always been such a huge fan of hers. You know, of course the vacation movies, Chevy Chase, but I always remember her from Coal Miner's Daughter and one of my favorites, Hair.
Right.
She was so so that's going to be fun. I'm going to talk to her, and I just interviewed Lindsay Klingman for Turner Classic Movies, so I'll get to talk to her about that. But we were talking before, Bev, I love those vacation movies. God, weren't they funny?
Yes.
We were the hippie family, you know, so like going on a trip was a huge deal. First of all, like we'd start, you know, we'd start early, but didn't leave the house till about 3 o'clock.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
It just took that long to get everything together.
Yeah. And as you can imagine, I'm ready, packed night before.
Sure.
Can't wait to go to my grandparents' house in Vermont.
Right.
My grandfather, Melvin Douglas. And the rest of the family, we forget this, the bathing suit, dad needs a smoke, go back in, I need some more coffee, mom has to go to the bathroom. It's like, oh my God, is the summer like ever going to start? And then my father would have anxiety attacks on the highway. And so if the three kids were in the back, you know, we'd be fighting or whatever, he'd always, can't get away with this today. But he'd try to reach back, like, to hit us.
Hit you.
And then he'd say, Joan, hit the kids. Hit them. Just hit them. And then the other thing he'd do is he'd always, I'm pulling the car over. Did anyone's dad do that? That's it. That's it. We're turning around. Pulling the car over. And it was like,
then you know you're in real trouble.
Yeah. So by the time we got to, you know, Vermont, and then we would show up and everyone else was like all of our really wealthy relatives, and we were like the dirty hippie kids.
Yeah.
But that was like the only trip. But then all the other trips I did were with, because I spent a lot of time with my Italian grandparents. So, you know, like traveling with two immigrants, like as a little kid, that was like the bane of my existence.
Oh,
like that
really?
Was the other thing where, you know, you'd go 40 miles an hour driving to the Catskills. We went to, we're at the Catskills, Hershey Town. And I was always like the lonely kid in the pool, you know, that always dreamed I'd meet some like nice friend and she'd invite me home to live with her. And they'd be like, are you here with your parents? I'd be like, well, not really.
Sort of.
Italian grandparents.
I'm happy to give them up, though, if you've got a better offer.
But my grandmother, everywhere we went, like, she carried Lysol, and we used to have to, like, I would, you know, it was, like, really an enjoyable trip.
Like the spray, the aerosol spray?
Yeah.
Or the like, liquid?
Oh, no, she had the spray and the liquid.
Oh,
and
wow.
She put the liquid.
Deluxe.
You'd have to wipe down everything in the hotel. You were constantly, you know, going to the bathroom, of course, every you couldn't touch anything.
No.
Everything had to be done.
Yeah, but did you ever get sick?
With a towel. No, I don't think
See?
I ever did.
Thank
See,
you,
Grandma. Grandma was right.
Yep.
And it was like,
because I'm the woman who does that now.
You do?
I get on an airplane, and because it seemed for a couple years there, every time I got on an airplane, I would get sick. And, you know, they say that the air is not the thing, it's what you're touching. Oh, and I have a friend who got hand, foot, and mouth disease in the last few months on
is
an airplane.
Even, like, I thought that, was, that ended so, in World War II.
So disgusting. Like, you get blisters on your fingers, like, they peel. It's absolutely awful. From an airplane. So I'm the gal.
Call it Donald Trump disease. Instead of, like, call it something. Call it, find somebody you hated from your childhood. I never want to hear hand, foot, and mouth disease again.
So I'm the one who carries the handy wipes with me. Yeah. I wipe everything down. By the time I get any place, my hands are like crusty little bits because the alcohol in those cleaners dry everything out. But darn it, if I don't come out well every time, I don't get sick anymore on airplanes.
Well, you're there very you lucky. You're very lucky.
Me and your grandma.
Yeah, grandma was great. My last, one of my great, great trips, people should do this. I went with it was three generations, me, my mom, and my grandmother, and we were in Italy, and we were staying in Rome, and we got on the train. You know, we were going to all different places. And in the morning, we got on the train, and my grandmother pulls out this towel that she'd stolen, you know, with the Colosseum on it and stuff. And my mother starts yelling
from the
at
hotel.
Her.
Stole it from the hotel.
My mother goes, "You're not supposed to take that." My grandmother's like, "What? Well, if they want you to take it." You know, typical Italian. They want you to take it. Yeah, I'm sure they do. And then my grandmother my mother goes, "No, because I took a towel." And so then my mother takes out a towel, and they're laughing because they both got towels. And I go, "Well, this is just great," because I, of course, take out the towel I had stolen.
Set of three.
And we have three towels. So every time when I'm home with my mom, we always have our... have the towels.
Italian Colosseum towels.
And those are the memories that you cherish. The time your entire family turned out to, like, peasants, went to a nice place and stole towels. Yeah, those are the good memories. But anyway, it's going to be so exciting to talk to Bev.
So yeah, let's bring her in.
The great Beverly D'Angelo, who is, of course... My goodness, what hasn't she been in, aside from the, the National Lampoon Vacation films? She was in American History X, of course, Coal Miner's Daughter, Every Which Way But Loose. I have not spotted you in Annie Hall. But you could maybe tell us where. Entourage, Lansky, which I mentioned. Over 60 films, please. Please welcome the great... Beverly D'Angelo. Did you ever hear the name Texas Guinan?
Yeah.
I thought
it was Guinan.
No, I believe it's Texas Guinan.
Are you sure it's Guinan? It's not Guinan.
Well, we could.
We could fight about it. Do a search. Okay.
But yeah, if they ever had a Texas Guinan,
well,
you'd be so perfect.
Thank you, but I got to say this role I have in this Netflix show about
really
nails. Yeah, yeah.
Insatiable.
I don't even know. Their Netflix has 3,000 shows.
I know it does. Thank God.
Yeah, that's good. They're employing a lot of people. Yeah. Okay, but we'll get to Insatiable, but I have to.
But I think that's as much as I can say.
Oh, okay.
No, because they did everything. Don't know social media until they're
right.
But this is.
That must be tough, isn't it? Well, we're cineasts. Yeah. We're going to go deep cuts.
Okay.
Starting with my favorite. First of all, I'm
so got that photograph. Okay,
thrilled that you're here. Oh, it's
see,
amazing.
I look at these photographs and
pretty.
Think of, you know, where I was in my life during the making of that film. I was living in Italy. So that
which
was
one
convenient.
Is it? I can't see it from here.
That's European Vacation. Oh, that's up there. Uh-huh.
That's not, and what part of Italy were you living in? We were just talking about Italy.
Oh well, I lived in the family holding of my husband, who was a duke.
Wow.
It was called Villa Salviati. It still is. And I know my father had horrified them once by saying, you know, you ought to turn this into a hotel. Cut to Sting did rent it and make soul cages there. So it wasn't such a crazy idea. But we were ahead of the time because I married him in 81. And Rome, I'd say. I know.
Beautiful. But, just talking about Rome.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
Just talking about it.
Every time I'd get off the plane, my bones would relax.
Aww.
And everybody looked familiar. And the thing that's funny is when people go to Italy, you know, as life's gone, they've come back and they'll say, oh, now I get what you look like. You know what I mean?
That's so interesting.
It's true, because I really do look Italian, even though,
yes,
of course, you know, you never get cast as what you really are.
Yes, I understand that completely. I feel I feel the same way. Yeah. I'm half Italian. So I'm going to take you all the way back to my absolute favorite question. I don't think I've ever asked you this.
Yeah.
Do you remember the first movie you saw and who took you to see it?
You know, I'm glad that I kind of got a heads up that that's your go-to question with everybody.
Yeah, because, I'm fascinated.
Yeah, because I'll tell you this. I literally can't remember the first film I saw because I grew up in Columbus, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
Every Sunday after church, I'd be dropped off at the local cinema for the matinees. It was like a quarter, and that's where all the kids went. So I saw every film twice, basically, at least one and a half times, because I'd be picked up around 5, you know, for dinner. And so although I really cannot tell you the first movie I saw on a big screen,
right,
I can tell you that there were two that made a huge, huge impression on me and were truly the first films that I saw that affected my concept of what a movie was. One was I went to not at the Sunday cinema, but our downtown. I went with my mother, and I grew up. I'm 66, so this means I'm talking about the 60s, early 60s, and late 50s. And going to the movies was a big deal. You got dressed up, and you know my mother would always like coordinate her purse and stuff like that. So it was a particularly big deal that we went to see Ben-Hur.
Wow!
And in a fantastic cinema. There was the RKO Palace Cinema. And I mean, in Columbus, there still are beautiful that they've kind of translated into other venues, but they had the good old-fashioned, like, you know, movie theaters that had two balconies and everything. So we saw that, and it was very moving. And when we came out, my mother said, "I feel like it should be raining." And for some reason, even though I was a kid, maybe 8, 9, 10, I don't even know what age I was, it all came together for me that because of what we'd seen and because of this world that we'd been transported to, it had a profound effect on our coming out into the light and how we would see things. And it just, even though it's kind of a sophisticated thought, that was a first for me. And that's when I got the boom power of what film was.
Right.
And the other one was on the Sundays. There was and this must have been like 61 or something. I don't know. But there was one of the movies in the double bill that day was called, I think it was called The Peppermint Lounge.
Wow.
And it was starring Joey D and the Starlighters, who had created the Peppermint Twist. And as far as I can remember, the whole movie was about the Peppermint Twist. But what happened was we all jumped up and we were dancing. So there were scenes on screen, and we were literally, like, you know, dancing in the aisles. And that was another kind of first, because it was that kind of like direct communion where you're where all of your feelings, all of your senses, and everything that you want to do, you know, motivates you, you know. So that was big. But the rest of my cinematic experience in my childhood was obviously, you know, slumber parties and chiller theater. And I was a real fan of, like, the worst movies possible. One that I'm still trying to track down. There was this one, because I used to make posters of them, too.
Oh, you did?
Oh, yeah, wow. I'd watch the movies and make posters. And there was one movie that I don't know the name, and I've looked for it. I've even, like, Googled, you know, pieces of info. I can't find it. Maybe I've made it up in my head.
You should ask Martin Scorsese.
Well, you know,
he's the only
I tell
you. Because he's the one, like, you. That's what I used to do. I was like, there's a scene, and the guy's drinking milk. He'd go, bigger than life.
Yeah, right. But this was, there was a scene where this guy's on another planet.
Okay, everyone's listening now.
I know, and I wonder if I've melded this with that movie where this astronaut goes to a planet and all the women bark instead of talking. But what I remember and what I made the poster of was that this guy was chased by an army of men that were dressed up to look like vegetables and had colanders on their head.
Oh my
with
God.
Carrots and rutabagas and stuff sticking out of the colanders, which I just thought was the greatest thing in the world. And I did make a very explicit poster of that, you know, the following day, as was my wont. But I did not
love that.
That was about as far as then I got into singing.
Yeah.
So I looked, and especially in the era when I did, that that's when so much of the talent of a culture was going into music, the late '60s.
Right.
You know? And when music wasn't corporate, and it purposely wasn't corporate, and there was an outsider view of what was really going on, and you could hear that in the music. It was equally inspiring, and I found that I could sing in this kind of miraculous way because I'd come out to California as an animator. Mm-hmm. I was a quiet girl, except for like around my friends, but you know, in general, I would say I was not an extrovert except with my close friends.
Right.
So the path of, you know, quietly drawing and sketching and stuff was very compelling. And I studied art, and I sent my portfolio to, studied art at American School in Florence, and I sent my portfolio to Hanna-Barbera and Disney. And they said, yeah, we'll hire you as an inker and painter. Hanna-Barbera paid like 25 cents more. So I came out to do that, but it was... It was, you know, you joined the union, and then there was a hiatus at that time. This is pre-computerized. And
what year, just so I know?
69.
69.
I was 17.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, and that came to play with the singing business because, so the deal was you worked for a season, and then you were on hiatus for 4 months and got unemployment, and then you came back for the next season. But having not quite completed the first season, I also was living with this guitar player that I was madly in love with. Hometown boy who played in a band that was called Other People, very political, lots of free concerts at Griffith Park where I'd rip off my top and light a $5 bill on fire and all that stuff, the hippie stuff.
Yes.
And
I know all about it.
I know you do. We have that in common. I chose it. You were victimized.
I blame Dennis Hopper.
Yeah. You blame so Dennis Hopper. I can only blame myself. What happened was I'd grown up in a very musical family.
Yeah, your dad, didn't he play with Harry James? And
no, my dad was a sideman who played with all of them at the end of the big... He was on the road with Tommy Dorsey.
Uh-huh.
With, Tony Pastor. He went on the road at 16 with Tony Pastor, and his vocalists were... The vocalists for that band were Rosemary Clooney and her sister Betty.
Wow.
Which was ended up being a circle around when we became friends when I came out here. Because she befriended everybody who came out here. But he did side gigs with everybody, sideman gigs with everybody, pickup bands and stuff like that. Claude Thornhill, the Thundering Herd. Who's the guy with the Thundering Herd? Okay, anyway, yes. And my mother had gone through Smith College on a violin scholarship. So I had that in my home, right. But my older brother was a musician, was prodigious. He was pretty much of a prodigy. So that wasn't my... I'm sure you experienced this in your family, too. You know, it's like you take the corner that you can get so I could draw.
Yeah.
But when I left, I had always sung. Mm-hmm. But what happened was now I was freed. I'm in an amazing time in Los Angeles,
yeah.
1969. And I opened my voice and sang, and everybody around me changed. They treated me differently. And it was that thing of understanding that there was a way to change, the same way that my mother had walked out of a cinema and said, I feel like it should be raining, and the atmosphere had changed because of what we'd seen and experienced. I found that I could do that with singing. So that's all I wanted to do. I was like, I would put myself in situations where it was just inevitable that, I can sing. You know what I mean? And so that was really my path. It was not cinema. It was not acting. And the way I got into acting was because those doors opened more rapidly than any doors for a singing career.
Well, but just out of curiosity, if you had stayed at Hanna-Barbera, like what would have been your? Did you think I want to be a, you know, Chuck Jones or?
I wanted to be an animator,
funny animator.
I wanted to. I mean, I got up as far as backgrounds, and then I left. But yeah,
it's so interesting because I can't even imagine. Like, did they have many women animators in 1969?
No, but that didn't occur to me. You know, it's funny. It never occurred to me. The whole gender thing didn't really occur to me. But then, again, going back to the time that I took off at 17, you know, the culture that I was in,
right?
you know, it was kind of a, I didn't have to weed through any Catholic background or, yeah, or cultural prejudices. If anything, you know, my sexuality was, I don't know if courage is going to come out right, but what I mean is that was just part of the thing that was accessible.
Yeah.
You know, so I didn't think in terms of gender. Of course, everybody was aware, you know, we were burning bras. Everybody, yeah, was aware that there was oppression. But as far as oppression in my personal life, I just didn't find that.
Mm-hmm.
I can look back and say, well, there's that and that and that and that and that, but I can't say that it was in my mind that that I would be limited because I was a woman.
Right.
In terms of music, I felt a certain limitation because of the kinds of women's voices that were in rock.
At that,
you know,
time.
They weren't like mine.
Right.
You know what I mean? There was kind of like Joni Mitchell, and then, mm-hmm, there was Janis Joplin.
Right.
You know, maybe in the country and Western world, yeah, but I was a real snob about that because I grew up surrounded by it. I grew up on bluegrass music. I knew all of that stuff. I could play a fucking banjo, or sorry. You know what I mean? So that's what you don't want to do. You know what I mean?
So when you were, you know, when you were on the road as a singer and as a background singer, I mean, as a young, I mean, that must have been scary, or was it just very common?
No, it was just great. You know, I ended up, well, so what I did was, I remember I told you the 17-year-old thing.
Yeah.
So Joe, my first true love, who now, I think he does the lighting for Mershon Auditorium in Columbus, Ohio. I'm not sure. Anyway, Joe noticed, as they all did, as I said, it was a political band. It was called Of the People.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, that was a political time, and that was also a time when you know, there were a lot of things happening with politicized musicians, you know, or anybody that an establishment could view as a rabble-rouser, or what do you,
right,
want to say, or a revolutionary, or, you know, anything like that. So we did draw a lot of attention to our little, mm-hmm, communal setup because there was the music and a lot of talk that went on with that. And they noticed I was 17. And at a certain point, Joe said, you know, you're jailbait and you're drawing too much attention to yourself, which was true.
Yeah.
Because I was just along. I was kind
of
like
in the 50s, that wouldn't have been an issue. But maybe that's because everybody was under contract.
Well, it was just Los Angeles, 1969, and people were gunning for these outsiders, really. I mean, I'm taking, yeah, it out of context, but outsiders who were gaining a lot of influence on a huge, the baby boomer generation, a huge section of capital.
Right.
You know what I mean? So you can bet that they wanted to make sure those people were under control.
Well, so you were on the road. And then
so then I took off.
Yeah.
And started singing in coffee houses and joined a band in New York, and then the
you
guy got
Broadway.
Electrocuted. No, did Broadway way at the end.
At the end of that? Is that in the 70s?
Broadway was an accident. Okay, traveling around. Ended up, to make a really long story short, I was doing this commune kind of circuit.
Yeah, we've got to get to the
Okay, so I'm going to get there really fast. It goes like this.
Don't
it goes.
Like,
I'll just save it for my book, and I'll just tell you.
No, you can tell.
Okay.
John.
All right. So anyway,
you come back.
Ended. I'm going to make it really short. It was on a Ken Kesey was arrested. Some of his merry pranksters bought some land in
Oregon. Was it?
No, in British Columbia.
Oh,
wow.
I was in a band in New York. We played an outdoor concert at Bard. The guitar player got electrocuted because it was a wet grass. He didn't.
Hey,
die.
Man.
He didn't die, but it was, that was the end of that band. And so it was like, we're getting killed, you know. So went to this place on the west coast of Canada, and in true communal thing, you did what you could. So I formed a square dance band. And this guy from it was Colin Square Dances, and this guy from Toronto wanted me to do backup vocals on his album, went to Toronto. I ended up immigrating to Canada as a backup vocalist. And I would look in the newspaper for singing gigs. I joined the union playing tambourine and maracas because they would guarantee you a job. I played at like a mental hospital for New Year's Eve and just thought, God, I've got to get a better gig than this. The best gig in town was Ronnie Hawkins because Ronnie had been there with, he'd brought his band, the second of his bands called the Hawks. They'd left him to go with Dylan, but Ronnie had remained and put together one amazing band after another, and that was the gig to have.
Yeah.
And I heard he was looking for a vocalist, and at the time I was singing just down the street from where he was on Young Street, and at a place called the Zanzibar, which was a topless bar. I was clothed, but I was in an evening gown, and there were two girls on either side of me, and every 40 minutes I'd say, "Now, gentlemen, it's swing time," and the topless girls would get off of their oil cans that had, you know, plexiglass with the lights, you know, get in trapezes and fly across the heads of these guys who were like stacked up, you know, in that kind of, in these rows. Great jazz, though, and fantastic drummer, because if I just went like this, I can guarantee you the drummer would go,
yeah,
you know what I mean? Notoriously great musicians in strip clubs. And I was kind of into jazz. Ronnie was rockabilly, but again, best gig in town and fun. Walked down the street, auditioned for him with a Les McCann tune, which was totally out of the ballpark for him. But he literally said, "Stick with me, honey, and I'll have you farting through silk." So it was just great. It was fabulous, and it was a great experience. The band kept expanding and expanding and expanding. And then, and now I'm going to get to movies really fast.
Well, I'm just curious. So you met the band.
Oh, yeah, I knew those guys, yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
so. They were around. They were in and out. Also, I'm talking 71, 72 now, and they were really hitting it. So Ronnie,
yeah.
Everybody that came through town would come to our gig.
Yeah.
And either sit in or just sit there.
That's it. Do you remember anything that was just, like, life-changing about, like, oh, I was there the night they drove Old Dixie down? No. I was there, like, you know, did they just sit around? You're like, were you prescient that this was something big and important, being around the band?
Well, we were in Toronto. The band lived in New York, and they were on tour, and they were doing their own thing, and they were destined to end, like, you know, within a few years.
Yeah.
I was doing exactly what I wanted. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So I didn't see the various celebrities, if you will, that would come by. But they had a special, they were more connected, but they were just like band member. I mean, I don't, as far as prescient,
right?
I didn't envision doing more than that. I figured, you know, things would just keep evolving.
Yeah.
You know, I'd get more songs of my own and stuff like that. But then what had happened was, I can't tell you exactly what happened, but what happened was I was in a position where I got a phone call saying, "Ronnie's been arrested, don't come to the gig."
Uh-huh.
And I had to get out of, you know, preferably get out of town.
Right.
So I auditioned for a repertory company, because in the meantime, when I was singing with Ronnie, I had studied opera, and I had also done a radio musical for CBC, playing Marilyn Monroe. And the guy who wrote that had written a musical version of Hamlet. I made it into the repertory company, toured with their repertory company for the full year, came back to Prince Edward Island, and again, this is the absolute God's truth. A producer came up, saw the show, brought up Gower Champion, who is a big director
on
Broadway.
One of the biggest.
And Bye Bye Birdie and
42nd Street.
And all that kind of stuff, yeah. And it was really, you know, fire everybody but that girl. And and I went to Broadway. And it opened on Broadway. They didn't even tour it out of town. They considered the 7 months tour in Canada good enough. And they built the sets into the stage of the Minskoff Theater, which held 3,000 people. It closed in a week. So there I was. But I got all the reviews for the show. And I remember when it closed, I said to everybody, you know, it wasn't that great in Canada. And the whole cast was like, "Why didn't you tell us? You know, we've killed ourselves to do this." Anyway, but I got calls from casting directors. And there was a theater agent who had come to me at the closing night. And he said, "I know people are calling you. I can help you with that." I said, "Great." And I was called in to meet Woody Allen. And I always kept a diary. To this day, I have, like, you know, I have to add on, like a hoarder. I've got these diaries. But just a house, and but I had had a dream about him, and I brought my diary, and I went in Marion Doherty's. Mm-hmm. It was Marion Doherty's office on 33rd or something like that.
Yeah,
and it was nice to meet him. And I said, I had a dream about you, and I read him the dream, and he said, oh, well, I'm making this movie. Can you come and do it? And I said, yeah, you know, when? It was just like that. He said, you know, in 2 days, and Marion will get in touch with this guy, Jeff. And so I went. Now, you have to understand, I was so naive about any kind of filmmaking, so naive, that when I went there and spent the day shooting, I thought, well, I must be starring in the movie, because it took 12 hours. So obviously, it's all about me in this scene. I mean, it was really, you know, like, we shot, and then we went out to lunch, and then we came back. So I just thought, and I remember kind of inhaling something that was happening in New York then, certainly not now when you mention his name, but back then, which was that whenever I'd go for subsequent interviews, because things did really start to happen fast, you know, I said, well, I'm in this Woody Allen movie. And they're like, oh, my God, because they didn't know about what was in that. It was Annie Hall. Right. And the scene that I was in was Tony goes to, goes to Los Angeles to become a television star.
Right.
Remember? And Woody Allen comes out, and he's like, really, like, how you've sold out and how awful.
Yeah.
Because, no, you got to see it. So they go to a studio where they're dubbing it or editing it or mixing it. And on the teeny little screen, like about that size, there's me in a scene saying something like, my brother, the Neanderthal man. But that got me my Screen Actors Guild card. And that's when everything started happening. So the next big thing, the next big first, was Hair. Because that was a movie that I was totally qualified for, and that I hadn't seen Hair. It had been in L.A. when I was here as a teenager, but it was like, God, I am a hippie. I'm going to watch this, like, singing, dancing version. How crass. So, you know, I really had an attitude about it until I actually ended up doing the play, like, just a few years ago at Hollywood Bowl. But anyway, so the whole deal was it was preferable that you hadn't seen, and you certainly couldn't have been in it because you'd be too old.
Right.
So I was right in the pocket, 22, could sing, could dance, although Twyla didn't really think I could. So I didn't dance in it.
Yeah, tell the story about what she said, dancing is just repeating.
It was fantastic. I was doing, I don't know whether it was, I had did so many auditions that I don't know whether it was an audition or an actual, like, rehearsal or something. And she said, you know, walk across the room. So I walked across the room. And then she said, okay, now do it over again. And so I thought I did, and she went, no, you ran your hands through your hair. And she said, that's what dance is. It's just being able to repeat, you know, to repeat a movement. And I'm sure she said it more eloquently, and I would beg her pardon if she thinks that I've distilled her raison d'etre to a crummy little story about me. I would never deign to do that. But, yeah.
And how did you meet, what did you think of Milos Forman? Did you think he was the right person?
I loved him immediately. Oh, yeah, because, the right person to do the musical?
Well, such an American, he's Czechoslovakian.
No, his story was really interesting.
I love the film, by the way.
Well, it's funny.
I interviewed Lindsay Klingman, the editor.
You're kidding me, who's one of my dearest, I've known her for since that.
She's great.
Her mother, her brother.
Yeah.
Did Lindsay do Grace in My Heart?
She did not. Someone named Thelma Schoonmaker did.
Okay, yeah. Oops, sorry about that.
That's okay.
Yeah, Lindsay's one of the greats. Yeah, that was the beginning of a lifelong friendship with Lindsay.
Yeah, Lindsay was great, and she did One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Did she tell you about the gray room, how Milos wouldn't let any posters in there or anything?
No, go.
Well, I'll get to that. Anyway, what was my impression of Milos in terms of, was he the right person for it? First of all, I had no kind of, speaking of prescience, I had no attitude toward who was qualified to make what film or what. I was going to be a singer.
Right.
And this was the door that was opening, and I was singing in it. Mm-hmm. And it required acting, but sure, I can do that. Because also, Milos, I remember asking him, what do you think the most important thing a director does, or what do you think the most important thing you do as a director is? And he said casting. Mm-hmm. And his casting was very interesting. He would keep auditioning and making different chemical, you know, groupings and stuff till everybody arrived at where they should be. And then his direction was very rudimentary. It's like he cast well. Mm-hmm. So anyway, which was funny for me because I was coming from this hippie, wild rock and roll background and I was a debutante, but he saw it in me. He saw that.
Yeah.
But as far as his qualification, this is a man who was a truly revolutionary filmmaker in Czechoslovakia and had to flee. And he had seen the musical of Hair when he was still, you know, behind the Iron Curtain, mm-hmm. in Czechoslovakia, and it moved him, and he made a vow to himself that when he had the opportunity, he would make a film of that. The biggest difference between Hair as a film and Hair as the musical had to do with, and it didn't, I remember Rado and Ragney were kind of loud about this, they talked about it. Hair is a musical, because I did end up doing it at Hollywood Bowl and actually getting what it was. Hair is a musical was 12 characters who played different roles, and they went through the fourth wall, and there was improvisation, and it was in the context of a Broadway show, my God, it was like explosively different. Whereas Milos and Michael Weller approached it in a more traditional musical form, in that every song either, you know, the traditional musical form is that every song either furthers the plot or develops the character.
Right.
So they saw it in that context. And if you were comparing the two, which again is apples and oranges, but if you were comparing the two, mm-hmm. you could say that the filmmaking itself was not the equivalent of what that play had been on Broadway. But he was, you know, Lode School educated and an incredible filmmaker. And I think that what stands up about that movie is even beyond content, in that, yeah. that it's the filmmaking.
Yeah, I think some of the images in it, that's what's, you know, because my recollection seeing it as a kid.
Andrzejczyk. Mirek Andrzejczyk, the cinematographer.
Oh, it was gorgeous. Yeah, gone. And some of the images in it, you know, that just really stayed with me.
Yeah.
When you did the Good Morning Starshine scene, are you being towed there? Is that playback? How is that technically?
Singing
car number is...
Yes, I've been in a lot of cars, as it turns out.
My book fell, so.
A lot of cars. There was a helicopter shot.
Yes.
There's a helicopter shot. I'd have to look at it again to really remember, but as far as I can recall, there was a camera truck. I'm assuming that cameras were, you know, bump.
Did you have playback?
Mounted on... Yeah, I always had playback. We did the...
In an earbug, or in those days, did they not have an earbug? Earwig, or whatever.
You know what?
It's called.
We didn't use earbuds. We just had a playback.
Yeah.
We just had a playback. But the thing is, we had recorded it, so as far as lip syncing, you know, you knew what you were doing anyway. It's not like trying to.
It's not the easiest thing in the world to do.
It's always been easy for me because I just go for the breaths. It's all about the if you can find the breath. That was the key to Patsy Cline. If you can find the breaths,
right,
then you know how much support it is, and you know what the phrase is, and you know. It's all about the breathing, mm-hmm. you know. And that happened with Coal Miner's Daughter. A couple things happened with Coal Miner's Daughter when we were laying down those tracks, because we did four tunes, and I got cut. A lot of my stuff got cut out of Coal Miner's Daughter.
Is there a DVD extras or?
Oh well, we did do an album. It's all on the album.
Oh, okay,
Crazy Walking After Midnight.
Yeah,
two other Sweet Dreams in its entirety. But yeah, I got the letter on that one. Like, it's not about you. We'll make the Patsy Cline movie, and then they didn't. It wasn't about me.
I'm skipping ahead, but when they did the Patsy Cline movie, like, did they say, well, you've already played Patsy Cline?
No.
I
was attached. We were at the Golden Globes for Coal Miner's Daughter, and the producer turned to me and said, we're going to be back here with Crazy, because Bob Getchell, uh-huh. who had written Coal Miner's Daughter, had written a script called Crazy, and it was about Patsy Cline. I was living in Italy then, from 81 mm-hmm. on, and... My agent, Rick Nacita, at that point, I was with CA, would call me and say, you know, you're still into this? And I go, well, yeah, what's happening? He goes, well, it just went into turnaround here. So they were having trouble. So I'm back in L.A. Now it's like 84. And the producer called me and he said, you know, we found this independent thing that's connected. It's back at Universal again. Mm. And there's an independent company called Silver Screens. And so they just want us to, you know, open it up. I mean, we've always been focused on you, you know, because you can sing, because you're a singer, blah, blah, blah. It's always been about you. But they just want, it's just, you know, protocol. They just want us to open it up to other actresses. You know, and it's, and
it's always nice to
hear. I said, like, who? And he goes, well, you know, Jessica Lange just got an Oscar. So, you know, probably that. But, you know, and I called my agent and said, what's going on? What's going on? What's going on? And he said, it's just, you know, not protocol.
The process.
Formality.
It's just a formality.
They use these words.
Yeah, it's just a formality. Process. Well, it was so formal that it was like, she's doing it. So it was, and by that time, I think that was 83 or 84, but whatever it was, you know, I just, it was like, okay. Nobody's ever going to get me here, and I just don't get this. And it had nothing to do with her, but it had to do with the process.
Right.
And it had to do with how I saw myself fitting into what I saw that world was and deciding if I had the energy or not to get to the other side of it. And I really, to this day, you know, it's very interesting what's going on in my career right now with this kind of surfeit of work that just popped up. But mm-hmm. I think that had to do with just finally saying, whatever. You know, I give up, and then boom, Christmas presents arrive. But, you know, I from a very early point, you know, I'd come into it as an outsider, was fascinated by filmmaking because the technical stuff.
Right.
And also, you know, the story. I mean, I kind of think, well, maybe I should be a storyboarder. Maybe that would
be
the way.
Well, that goes back to your animation.
Right. That was like in my mind. Well,
yeah.
Okay, didn't get the Patsy Cline movie, maybe I could be a storyboarder. And like, you know, but anyway, I also was living out of the country.
Yeah.
I lived out of the country from 81 to 91.
Right.
So as far as I said, supplying that energy to get to the other side, mm-hmm. I didn't have that ambition.
So you did know? You ever run into Jessica Lange and eye each other
well, I
up
did,
and down?
Well, you know, it was weird. Like, I got to say, it was
like
weird.
Horses.
I think she's great. Well, funny you should mention horses, because another weird tale. You know, I have all these adventures. Now I'm in Australia. I'd done a movie with that guy, you know, Paul Hogan. And
oh, yes, that's right.
Yeah, and
Crocodile
so now I'm in, I didn't do Crocodile Dundee. I did another thing called Lightning Jack. But now I'm in Australia. And it turned out another friend of mine was also doing an independent film in Australia. And he had a houseboat. So I got the houseboat and just went up and down the Wentworth River for about a month, not even thinking if I had a legal visa or not. But my friend, the actor, said, hey, listen, my agent represents Sam Shepard. He's trying to reach you. I'm on a houseboat in Australia. And sure enough, it was true. And he wanted me to, he had a play. Mm-hmm. So, and it was set for Broadway. So when I came back about a month later, I don't think I can ever go back to Australia either because I did outstay my visa.
Oops.
You know, but that's another story. But anyway, I was like toting didgeridoos from the Outback. But anyway, so originally it was going to go into a Broadway house, and that kind of collapsed. And then a year later, he said it's going to happen at the Public. So there we are. It was me, Fred Ward, Marcia Gay Harden, Ed Harris, and James Gammon. And we had a limited run at the Public. I received the Theater World Award. And it was pretty great. And on closing night, mm-hmm. Jessica did come. And I was thrilled. And it was one of those ones like, hi.
Yeah.
And it was, hi. So did I ever have that bonding experience? No. I had met her much, much earlier in life.
Oh.
I'd met her much earlier in life.
We both played.
Yeah, I know.
There's nothing worse than one actress is wants to do that, and the other one, you go, oh,
well,
okay.
But you know what I had? I did have an experience with Katie Lang that was the opposite.
Uh-huh.
I was on a plane, and Katie Lang, who I wish would record more because she's one of the great voices
great
of
voices,
all time.
Yes.
She came up to me, and she said, well, you've got to come up to Vancouver. We got to have like a Patsy Cline night. Cut to I've been told she's now living on my street, so I should go to, but that's like the complete opposite of like we're all, you know. in this together. This little small town.
Wow. I'm very curious just about your.
Although maybe she was just shy. Who knows? Who the fuck knows?
Your experience of working with Tommy Lee Jones, which it's like you always just hear stories. You always hear stories like he is the grumpiest person in show business.
Well, I don't know.
I've never met him.
I mean, that
he's so talented. He's so good in that film.
So is Levon from the band.
Yeah,
that's how that all happened. So.
What's his work process like? Is he standoffish?
I'm not the person to ask. I can only tell you of the scene that I shot with him that's not in the film. There was a scene that I shot with him where he comes to a bar where I'm singing Walking After Midnight, and we talk about his marriage and what he's got to do and what he doesn't have to do. And then there was also, I think, in that scene that we shot in Tootsie's Lounge. But again, that film, you know, Michael Apted was coming from the world of documentary. Sissy Spacek, I can tell you about her work ethic.
Yeah, please.
Which is, I'm more knowledgeable about. Yeah. She was amazing. She carried the whole production like a feather on her shoulder. She was incredibly, she had that thing that is the what every actor must have to engage what's ever going to pass through him. Just the ultimate flexibility. Mm-hmm. You know, and because of Michael Apted's background in documentary filmmaking, and because it was such a, you know, Loretta Lynn is and was, you know, so beloved, everybody in town would come and visit and hang out. There was lots of music. There was kind of a free-flowing thing, which was very comfortable for me, where I was coming from, really comfortable for everybody. So as far as, you know, a work ethic, she just was there every day enjoying the moments and looking for moments. And as an actress, you know, I was just so, and especially in hindsight, so appreciative of how in the moment she was. She has that gift, and certainly it shone brightly, you know, in that.
Yeah,
that role.
The truthfulness of the movie. And because, again, it's not easy to.
It was sincere.
You know, one of my favorite lines is when she goes, I'm going to have a baby.
Yeah,
you know,
I'm going to have a baby.
It's just like, she's so good.
Yeah.
And I love the way it's shot and the rural
quality. She was amazing.
Quality. It reminded me a little bit of that film, the documentary, Harlan County, USA.
Well, same area.
Yeah.
Appalachia.
But it had that real truth. I love the smokiness of some of the shots and
the fog
early morning.
From the clouds, yeah.
And the cold. You could. It really had that.
Foggy Mountain Breakdown. Ding, 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 ding.
Yeah. And the scenes with the bar. I mean, you know, not to compare it to the Patsy Cline movie, but that has the more traditional Hollywood.
Well, yeah, it's
stuff.
That thing of, you know, you always have to be careful of, I think every individual does, and even an industry, you know, has to be careful of letting another person's definition stand in the way of the definition you have of yourself.
Right.
And, you know, there's a real tendency to exploit everything, mm-hmm. you know, and that has to do with an anticipation that people are going to watch it for these elements, and you get askew. And there was a purity in Coal Miner's Daughter that was a real through line, I think, that really came out.
It's a beautiful film. Yeah. So switching gears, getting into the, of course, the vacation movies.
Into this century.
And did Harold Ramis know that you were funny? Like, who knew that you were funny? How did that come your way?
Just did a thing with Chevy 2 days ago about this. For ABC, it was an audition. Again, Married to the Duke. Read the script.
To the Duke.
Read the script.
I like that.
Read the script.
Yeah.
And I was 29 at that point. I had just done Coal Miner's Daughter, but it hadn't come out. I'd done Honky Tonk Freeway, and it hadn't come out. I'd done a movie with Burt Reynolds that came out, and thankfully no one noticed. But so, you know, I was kind of going one direction. I had some cachet, I'd say.
Yeah.
But I wasn't defined as a comedian, per se.
Yeah.
I was just an actress who played these three vastly different roles. I'd done a leading lady and a character role in Patsy Cline. So, read the script, and I'm the parent of teenagers. And I'm going, well, okay, I'd be 14 when I had a 15-year-old. Okay. and there was a dog in it, you know, so kids, dogs. Oh, wait. I forgot the whole thing. Clint Eastwood.
Yes.
I had done this big, huge movie that Clint Eastwood made called Honky Tonk Freeway.
Yes.
And which was meeting him was great.
I know. I have that. You're going to have to come back.
Okay. All right. Well, anyway, so I'm looking at it and I'm going, should I really be doing this?
Yeah.
And my husband said, but look, it's very funny. Look at this cousin Eddie. That's very hilarious. So I went into my first meeting with Chevy and Harold, suggesting Richard Pryor's wife.
Uh-huh.
Like, maybe you want to meet Jennifer Leake. She was a friend of mine. I thought, well, she's funny and he's funny. We improvised something, and then they called me back like 2 days later, and I really didn't see myself in it at all. I said, what am I doing here? Like, why am I here? And they said, oh, we just wanted to see what you'd wear. And that was it. So it was more like, well, I mean, I recognized who Chevy was in a heartbeat. You know what I mean? I had his number. Harold, sweetest. These were really, really smart boys. And, you know, it's unusual to be around really, really smart boys all the time. And I love that. So there was a certain, you know, connection that had to do with humor because we were all smart people.
Right.
You know, and we're intelligent. I'm not educated, but I'm really... But, you know, I like to use my brain and stuff like that. So it was the land of the imagination more than, like, sex appeal or anything. And I liked that.
Very much so. The reason I think these movies work is that you're in on the joke versus sometimes today with these family comedies. It's like,
they get it wrong. But yeah. Here's why. That film was...
And they gave you lots of funny stuff to do.
But here's why. That film, and it was our intention, was a satire. It was R-rated satire, and we were satirizing.
That's true, National Lampoon.
Yeah, it was a satire. And what happened was, again, in Italy, I get the phone call, you're in the number one movie this weekend. My theory about what happened was that people watched the film, and instead of saying, ha ha, look at those funny Griswolds, they went, ha ha, look at me. And they identified in a way that's true to this day. And they're the nicest people that like Vacation are the sweetest, kindest, family values, generous, loving people. I mean, they're the opposite of the American History X fans.
Right.
Who are like, verging on,
A movie, we'll get to that. But it's got a very nostalgic quality.
I always saw it as a love story anyway. Well, it was nostalgic because it was based on based on a story that had been written that was called
by John Hughes.
Yeah, by John. It was called Vacation 58.
Yeah.
So it was set in the 50s originally.
Are you a big fan? I mean, I'm a huge fan of John Hughes. I mean, I don't know that world, Chicago, but
it seems like
he really just captured.
Well, he created something because this was his first film.
Yeah.
And he was not only was he a rock solid Midwesterner, but he was also, you know, kind of anti Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And there were what John Hughes did that was game-changing was up until John Hughes, they cast people that were older to play teenagers because they believed that you had to be a little bit older to play younger. And I know I did a movie called First Love with John Hurd.
John Hurd.
Where we were playing college kids and we were both, you know, 22, 23. I mean, we weren't freshmen. But that was the thing. And I think that even the lead was like... not 30, but getting up there.
Yeah.
But that was the idea. And what John did was he wrote stories about young people and they played those young people. So there was a real veracity and a real sincerity. And he had the ability to hear that and write that and share it. And that's what he wanted to do. And he had a good heart. I know that on Christmas Vacation, I was so pissed off about something and I just thought, I'm going home. You know, I'm not doing this. Just somebody was lying to me big time to try to. I was positioned to protect somebody, and I didn't like it. And I said, I'm not a fall guy. You know, no, I'm going to go home till you get this sorted out because I'm not taking the fall for this behavior.
Right.
I'm here on time. I'm ready to work. Don't tell me that I'm in a shot where it's the top of my head. And that I'm resisting that, and that's what's making us late for the day. I was pissed off, so I called Gail and Frank Zappa and said, somebody's got to come and get me. So I went and had lunch, and then my agent called, and he said, you better go back. So I went back, and John had called me over, and we had this beautiful talk. And John said, you know, he said, I know what you mean. And he said, you know, are there too many 600-pound gorillas around you? Mm-hmm. And I said, like, in life? Or in this movie? Or what is it? And he said, no, in life.
Yeah.
And he meant it. And he ended up going back to Chicago. You know, he actively left Hollywood. You know that, right?
Yeah, oh, yeah. I could tell.
But he had a big impact as far as bringing the heart of a younger world.
And what did you learn, anything comedy-wise, that you learned from Harold Ramis as a director?
Oh, you mean the K things? The cliche? Well, the way that we worked was because it was film, so you couldn't improvise.
Right.
So we would rehearse a lot, and then when we had it, then we'd shoot where we'd come to.
Right.
There was a lot of improvisation, but you know, also Harold was one of the writers.
Yeah.
So it was all kind of around that. I remember. So we'd like get in our groove, and then it'd be like, okay, we got to shoot it now.
Right.
But we were on location. We didn't have anybody breathing down our neck. That whole film was shot on location, except for St. Louis. So it was
right.
Rep, but I mean, you know, anyway.
But when you're doing a scene, like just for as an example, I mentioned before the shower scene in the first, you know, it's so funny, but it's kind of innocent. But you could see like that type of family doing something funny and they're doing the video, which of course they've now made into a whole movie, like the accidental filmed video.
Oh, that one from European. Well, you know. It was all, I mean, that the banana, I don't think the banana thing was in the script. Maybe it was, I don't know. But it was just, it was really, Chevy and I always had great chemistry.
Yeah.
We just always had great chemistry, and it would start somewhere and then go somewhere. I do remember one thing. I remember Harold and Chevy trying to explain something to me, because I've always been a storyteller. And they said, you know, this is really important. When you tell your stories, if you want it to be funny, you have to make the funny part be the qualifier at the end. Does that make sense?
Sort of.
Okay, so it'd be like, well, I can't even.
And that's why it's called mashed potato or something like that. Or
like, you know, hey, horrific. It's great to see you. Be sure to take the mashed potatoes, which is a terrible example.
I know,
but it's
funny.
whatever it is that makes it funny has to be at the end of the sentence or something. I don't know if I took the right notes, you know,
like a punchline.
Well, but within the thing,
sure.
not a punchline. But
I know
but
what you mean.
The thing.
Yeah,
I think I understand what you mean.
If we come upon one, if we come upon an opportunity to restructure a sentence, so
no, you just did it.
Yeah,
I thought that was a great example.
No, that makes sense.
I thought that was. Makes you know
okay all right
anyway. And what about all the great character older character actors that you got to work with?
That was amazing.
I mean,
talk about sincerity. They were all so happy to work
and be funny and just
to show up
and
to feel those lights and that focus and the opportunity.
Just to throw out a name, John Randolph from Seconds.
Yeah.
A blacklisted actor, too.
Yeah, that's right.
And
Diane Ladd.
E.G. Marshall.
You know, E.G. Marshall. Doris Roberts.
Doris Roberts.
Yeah, I mean, collectively, to just be around that group, because they mostly worked in a group collectively, the kindness, the quietness, it was not like, you know, they were there to work and be respectful. And you just kind of got a glimpse of maybe another time. Because also, the vacation movies were really, you know, came from National Lampoon. They were.
Right.
There was a certain kind of cat. It was, you know, they were, again, outsider art.
And could they still work today, the vacation movies? Like, who is the director that would be a Harold Ramis? Like, who can take up that mantle? That because to me that's
that combination. What's that combination?
I don't look
of
at
Harold,
you. I know you and Chevy could do
it's
it.
It's the combination of the heart of John Hughes,
exactly,
and Harold's interpretation,
right,
and his gentleness with actors,
yeah,
you know, and his kind of awe
and that sweetness.
That sweetness, yeah, you know, they did a reboot. But I even thought that Vegas Vacation, I remember obviously I've never had a voice in how these films are made, but when Vegas Vacation came around, Melanie Mayron was tapped to direct it. I met with her. And it was one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was kind of not getting greenlit. And at the same time, Jerry Weintraub had a picture that was dumped. So Warner Brothers said, Chevy and Jerry, if you can work together, we'll greenlight Vacation.
Right.
Vegas Vacation. So Jerry, this was pre-Ocean's 11, was Mr. Vegas. So it was logical. But what he was adamant about was that we used the real Vegas. And I said, no, 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 that's not the formula. Because to me, the formula was this Griswoldian universe, a parallel universe, a satire, if you will.
Right.
But when you're positioned to interact with real people, and it's the real Wayne Newton, and it's the real Siegfried and Roy, you know, it alters things. And so for me, that was a more difficult road to walk because, you know, I was playing someone who, like, has an affair with or doesn't have an affair with Wayne Newton. And
right.
The reality is it's Wayne Newton.
Right.
And so, you know, there's, like, parody on top of parody on top of parody. But, you know, I kind of had to divorce myself from how I'd really feel if that was really happening. And
right.
That's not really my process as much. I'm not that removed. You know, I'm not that removed.
Yeah.
Like now I'm playing a role.
Well, plus, don't you have a certain responsibility, you know, with something that everybody loves so much? Do you ever feel that way? Like you'd be kind of afraid to do?
Well, you know, again, that's kind of a bit more outer directed. The responsibility I feel now mm-hmm. is to the fans. I mean, God, I'd like to thank the fans and the retailers. That's such a country and western thing to say, but but it's true. I feel a responsibility to them because they're so faithful and they're so legion and they're so kind. And now we're, you know, revving up to Christmas where it's going to be, you know, and all that kind of stuff.
You mentioned that you were making turkey, and of course, I immediately like the deflated.
The exploding turkey,
yeah.
I think that was model number two. I think the first one didn't. It was supposed to implode, so we just.
Did you ever have days where you just broke up and people broke up and couldn't go on?
You know, it's funny because as funny as they are, it was pretty tense. Again, it has to do with film. Because when we went back and Chevy and I just cameoed, I think I became the highest paid actress in the world per word.
Okay.
On the Vacation reboot, because mm-hmm. I think I said Clark, period, or something like that.
Yeah.
But anyway, we had a little cameo in the reboot, which again, it was not really a parallel universe so much. It was
I think they need to go on a cruise. That's what I would do.
Well,
if
you know,
Ileana
Chevy,
Douglas ruled the world.
Chevy had always talked about, you know, Swiss Family Griswold.
Yeah,
that's pretty good.
That's a
fun. We also talked
I like
about
that.
We
so
also,
they were stuck on an island.
At one point, I said, "Well, we should go to the moon," and he said, "Yeah." And then we missed the bus back. But you know,
I like Swiss
Family Robinson.
Yeah, that they're stuck on some island.
Yeah,
and there is a
Australia.
Yeah, Australia.
Yeah.
Or well,
if I can get back in.
Wait.
I want to get my story credit in here.
Okay.
What if they all go on a cruise and then they all fall off? They you know, they fall off the boat
and end
right?
up castaways on an island.
So that's like the beginning of it. You can't get credit for the whole script because it's never going to happen either. So.
In my own mind, it will.
Me too. I'll come over and watch that one.
Okay. We do not have much time left. So what do you... there's so much more to... Oh, my God. You have to... Will you promise you'll come back, right?
Cause you're I'll come back.
The
I didn't mean to take a straggling.
No, I wanted all of that. I did want to touch very briefly because you were very close friends with Carrie Fisher. I don't mean to make you sad at all, but it's like, isn't it kind of sad when you miss the sometimes when people go and they're friends, you're like, oh God, what they would have said,
what
or
they would
done.
Have said.
I'm just missing, man, a couple ad libs from Carrie Fisher.
We all are.
Yeah, it would be. Because when these great minds and these great wits go...
There goes the wit.
That's
what I said. I remember they called. It was just too soon, and I got some call to write something about her for, like, Hollywood Reporter or something like that. And I said, It's a book of eulogies. I mean, I can't. That's a 32-year relationship.
Yeah.
And, that's was key, was a turning point in at every step of the way. Very enmeshed lives. And all I could say was, you know, I said, this is a, put it in email form, which they didn't, but it was, Dear Carrie, since minus you in the conversation, we've all been reduced to half-wits.
Yes.
Oh, we've all, or, okay, to use the thing.
Yes.
Let me use the thing.
Okay, we're ready.
I'm going to use the thing.
Yeah.
The funny way to say it is, we've all, which way would you say? Oh, maybe I did say it that way. Since you're gone, so minus your part of the conversation,
yeah,
we've all been reduced to half-wits.
Yeah.
So half-wits is the qualifier, yeah, and the funny thing.
Yes.
The other way to say it, we'll decide which is funnier.
Yeah.
We've all been reduced to half-wits minus your end of the conversation.
I don't know. What do you go? I go with
half-wits
the,
is funnier to me.
Yeah,
half-wits. Half-wits. I like it as a, as a thing. Yeah. So that would be an example of, put the qualifier that makes it funny there.
Yes, I also think...
I hope. I hope, Jenny. I hope, Daryl.
We need to... I need a red phone to pick up. We talked about another amazing thing at Carrie Fisher's house was how many people met literally through the parties.
Oh my God.
That she would have every year.
Everybody. I met
the greatest.
Al there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I met Gary Shandling there.
He was there a
That's
lot.
That's how I got on the show.
Yeah. I met him there, too. But do you know what he said to me? He goes, oh, you know, you should do the... He said, you could do this show. He said, you could be like the actress who's always trying to get on and you never get on. And I was like, I
thanks.
Don't... I, thanks. I didn't quite see myself that way. Thanks, though. Thanks for thinking of me.
There was the party. Any excuse I can use to keep referencing the same image, because I was like, you could reach out your hands,
yeah,
and touch... You know, Warren Beatty, Jack Nicholson,
yeah,
Harrison Ford, Jennifer Jones was sitting there.
She was
Walken.
Fearless. She was an incredible hostess, and she was a hostess for everybody. She literally brought out the best. I mean, it's like that cliche. She literally brought out the best in everybody. And when she would have a party, everybody was as excited,
yeah,
to be there. Everyone was equally excited to be there.
Yeah.
And she just had a way of making it all happen. She'd kick off her shoes. There was something that was so brilliant about her that it was like a candle flame going through the room and igniting everybody. Because honestly, these stories you hear about her even now, like there was one time when Mick Jagger was there, and she walked up and she said, Mick Jagger's here. Right?
That's a good one.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah, no, she just, I mean, there are a gazillion of them, and
yeah,
and hopefully, you know, things will play out in a way that she will be eulogized and written about in a way that's accurate and perfect.
Yes.
And that, yeah, but it will happen.
Well, I want you to come back because you have to talk about Clint Eastwood.
Oh yeah, that was good.
Neil Jordan.
Yeah, that was good.
We both work with John McNaughton.
Yes.
I mean, there's...
Wait a minute. What did I do with John McNaughton?
That was what I said. We were in the same... That's what I said
what?
At the time. We were in the same movie, but we never met on it.
What was
Lansky.
The movie? Oh, that. Oh, oh! I thought you meant the guy who was Mr. Pepper or the Dr. Pepper guy. Dave, remember that actor that was in Griffin's movie, the Werewolf? John Naughton.
But isn't it John? Am I saying it
wrong? The director was John McNaughton, right? Or who's?
Yes.
Yeah,
isn't
okay.
it Henry? Isn't he John McNaughton? Now I'm feeling like I'm.
Yeah. No, he is.
He's
but
McNaughton.
I thought
Naughton.
No, but for a minute I thought you meant that we both worked with the.
I don't know.
I'm the Pepper.
Wait,
you're
isn't
the Pepper.
Isn't it David Naughton?
David Naughton. Well,
yeah.
I've got a knot.
It's got a knot in it.
Yeah.
We're going to be like...
But wait a minute.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We also both worked with Allison Anders.
Yes, we both worked with Allison.
We also know Danny
Allison.
Farrington.
Danny Farrington.
I feel like I was a bit stentorian there, like going on the... Oh, why the fuck was I talking about... Columbus, Ohio, and all this. We should have cut to the chase sooner.
We'll just have to have you come back.
I'm just going to have to write the book. You read it, and then we'll do highlights.
But
wouldn't
really,
that be better?
Fantastic.
But really,
instead
the,
of me blabbing
the main reason
on
I'm here is to say, what was up with the pterodactyl woman of
Beverly Hills?
Oh, God. Well,
what
my friend Philippe Mora came over to my house, and he said, and he was a friend of mine.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, do you want to... do this. And I just read the first page. And I said, fine. So we can shoot it in 5 days at my friend's. I said, fine, great. And he goes, I'll make you a producer. And I said, great. And so he never paid me.
Okay, of course.
And I called Moon Zappa and said, can you please cut over here?
Yeah.
And that's what that was. It was a token of friendship. I never.
It's your Pluto Nash, as I like to say.
I don't even think it's a Pluto Nash. I have no concept of whether people will watch what I do or not. It's all the same. Pterodactyl Woman to me is like the same as vacation. I really don't know what happens after that.
Yeah.
So you know what I mean. I had the same good intentions.
Yeah. Well, you'll have a whole. You're gonna come back and I predict a whole new.
A new outfit.
A new outfit or a new
visual?
Oh.
A new what?
I was going to say like a whole array of potential new films and films to make.
Well, I have a film, Unicorn. I've worked a couple of times with Robert Schwartzman, who's the last of that clan to become a director. He's Talia Shire's son. Mm-hmm. We just finished shooting Unicorn. I did his first film with him called Dreamland. This one's really fantastic. Beautiful, too.
Yeah,
his half brother shot it, and that's the only movie I have coming up. It's these two series that I'm doing.
I think they're like this whole sort of paradigm shift with women making movies and stories.
Well,
and
why don't you and I make a movie?
Well, let's do it.
I'll go see that.
I mean, now you can do it with
you can be in my movie
with an iPhone.
Yeah.
You know, I'll be in your movie if you be in mine.
Isn't absolutely.
That
kind
of, isn't that romantic?
Absolutely.
So, and I didn't mean that as sexual harassment.
I'd like to just be on a road trip with you just because
let's go.
I always think that
I want to go to New Orleans.
I would go to New Orleans.
You know what?
Once our friend Danny, we got to go to Monroe, though, to see Danny.
Right. Because I'll be in Atlanta, in a week. But I was coming out of a restaurant once, and Sean Penn came up to me, and he said, I'm going to go to New Orleans. I'm taking a road trip to New Orleans. Look at this car. And I looked at the car. It's like, all sorts of because you want to come? And I went, no. And I really should have.
Oh, my God.
See,
I
would have gone.
But then I saw him after that, and he said, I really regret that I didn't just get in the car that night. And he said, no, it's better that you didn't, because he said he went into a bar, and somebody gave him a drink that had like 14 tabs of acid in it.
Whoa!
Yeah, something
well,
like that.
Well, it could have been.
I know. Well, but that's the only one I can think of not
But if
doing.
You'd been there, maybe he wouldn't have gone in that bar.
I would have taken
Or maybe you would have been with the acid.
The final thing I want to say about Bev D'Angelo, which I probably never told you this, is that, well, aside from that, is that when something in the universe happens, and I bet there's other people too, like you're one of the first people I want to call and get your take on it.
Oh, Eliana, that's so sweet.
I absolutely mean that.
So why don't you call me after this and we'll talk about how it went.
Oh, yeah.
Look for it's Beverly in the upcoming series Insatiable on Netflix and Shooter on USA. Thank you, Beverly.
My pleasure.
You can buy Ileana's book, I Blame Dennis Hopper. Read it. Buy
for Christmas.
It. It's great. Excellent
out on
Christmas.
We have so much to talk about. I love her.
Out on paperbook. Also, check out our Facebook page. The website is ilianaspodcast.com.
Yes, thank you. And as I always say, everyone's life is a movie with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And this is the end of our movie for today. Have a great day, everyone.
Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Okay.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.